Hi, everybody. Thank you for welcoming me. Thank you, Rochelle Abramowitz, for sponsoring tonight. This year tonight should be Le'ilei Nishmat Avraham Moshe Ben Nasanata Halevi. First of all, hi. I'm very excited to be here. As you heard, I'm in my first year at GPATS. And it's really special for me to come back to Jamaica Estates, especially because I went to Central for high school. So I haven't been back in a while because I'm from Brooklyn. But it's really nice to have that change of scenery, be here again, and just get to enjoy. And thank you, Mrs. Shore, for coming out. So tonight, the shiur is titled, My Hanukkah. What is Hanukkah? And tonight, I really want to talk about the hidden story of Hanukkah and just understanding the bigger picture, right? We just came off of a very long weekend. We had Thanksgiving, which started Black Friday on Thursday, but then there was Black Friday on Thursday, Friday, Shabbos, and then it led to Sunday, and then there was Cyber Monday, and then there was Giving Tuesday, and now we're just at Wednesday. So let's just enjoy Wednesday, and let's look forward to what's coming up for now. Take a break, and let's look forward to the Chag that's coming up, the holiday that's coming up. So as we're starting and want to talk about more about the bigger picture of Hanukkah, tonight we're going to take a two-step approach. We're first going to look at the historical context of the story, the Hanukkah story, and then once we take a look at the historical context, we're going to take a little bit of a taste of what the rabbinic understanding of what the mitzvah of what the miracle of Hanukkah is, and then by combining the two, we'll see bigger messages and a bigger picture about Hanukkah. Okay? So everyone has a source sheet. Excellent. So the first thing we're going to look at is the historical context of the Hanukkah story. Tonight, what I'm basing a lot of the historical context on is a wonderful article by Dr. Lauren Schiffman, who's an expert in Second Temple Jewish history. I've written a tremendous amount on the subject. I highly recommend looking at the entire article because just the way he writes and the beautifulness of it is something really great. We'll start off with the date 323. As you see in number one, there's a timeline so we can all follow along. So we start at 323, which is the death of Alexander the Great, who was the ruler of the kingdom of Macedonia. And once there's one ruler that ends up dying, eventually one strong ruler will end up lead to a break in the leadership, unless there's another strong single person that can come and unite the entire empire. So after the death of Alexander the Great, if you take a look at your map, you can see that there's a split in the empire. It's split into two sections. The first empire is known as the Seleucid Empire. That's located towards the eastern side of the map. And if you look towards the western side, that's the Ptolemaic Empire. Each one of the Seleucids, a good way to remember it, is Seleucid, Syria, and onwards, eastwards. And the Ptolemaic Empire is from Egypt, Ptolemy, Egypt, that was kind of a weak one, but and going towards the west and understanding. And of course, we have that little tiny spot that's located right conveniently in the middle, which is the land of Israel. At the time, that was definitely an important piece of land, important area between the two empires, and it was definitely a point of tension between the two. And this is the area that we're going to be looking at. We're looking at, it was also known as Judea, where the Jews of the time, where Jews of Judea were looking at, and that's where the story of Hanukkah will take place. So we have this split, and between the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire, which are the two sides, we have this constant fighting back and forth. And in 198 BCE, right before the Common Era, I'm from Brooklyn, so when I was little, I thought era was error. So just like water is water. So I used to think it was a big error that people would count that way. Now I learned it was era, E-R-A. But before the Common Era, in 198, the Seleucids were able to they conquered the land of Israel under Antiochus III. This is not our Antiochus yet in the Hanukkah story. This is Antiochus beforehand. And they had full control. At the time, we have Jewish leadership, lay leadership, which would be the Kohen Gadol, the high priest at the time. But he didn't just play a religious role for the Jewish people. He also played as a political figure between just the empire, the larger empire, the governing body, and the Jewish people. So we have at the time Onias III is as the high priest, But afterwards, if we see in 175 to 164, that's the ruling of Antiochus IV. Antiochus IV is Antiochus IV of Epiphanes. He's the Antiochus that we're going to be talking about, the Antiochus of the Hanukkah story. So he rules over the Seleucid Empire. And at this time, originally we had Onias III, who was located in, who was the Kohen Gadol, the high priest at the time, but he was pro Ptolemy, which is the opposite of the Seleucids. Antiochus was the king of the Seleucids, and Ptolemy was the exact opposite. So he was, if he's the lay leader, or he's the connector between the Jews and the rest of the world, the Seleucid Empire is not going to be so happy with who he is because he sided with their enemies. So Onias goes and tries to beg for his life and tries to beg for his position, but he loses, and his brother, Jason, purchases the position instead. Jason, this is the first time that we have kind of a break in the direct line of the Kohen Gadol of how it would be passed from person to person, from generation to generation, but to the oldest child. And this is the first time which is going to lead to other breaks, and the role now of the Kohen Gadol we're going to see is no longer this just religious figure, just a place that can be passed down, but it's also going to be a position that can be bought. And that could be given to the highest bidder. So now we have Jason Oniad, that's his the family name. He now purchases the role of the high priest, and Antiochus is the king, and this is the political climate of the time. Okay, so Jason, as the high priest, not only is he doing stuff in the Mikdash, but he also has a little slant towards him. He is known as a mild Hellenizer. At the time, he was a big fan of the Hellenistic culture, of the culture of the larger empire of the secular world, and he decides that he's going to take Jerusalem, the capital, and he's going to build a gymnasium. A gymnasium at the time is not a gym that we think of right now, where you work out and those things like that. A gymnasium, yes, was a place for sports, but it was also a meeting place. It was a place for intellectual discussions, a place for a real communal center for everyone all together. And by building this gymnasium, he eventually starts bringing in this Hellenistic idea, which allows him to give some kind of credit/credibility to create Jerusalem into a polis, which is a Greek city by the name of Antioch. And he calls it Antioch after Antiochus. So now Jerusalem, which was once Jerusalem, is now known as Antioch as a Hellenistic city. Additionally, we see that although it was a Jewish city where many Jews were living, Jews were originally allowed some freedom of religious expression or some freedom of religious practice, but now that it became a polis, it became this hub of Greek culture, and many of the rights that were given to the Jews were taken away. So, additionally, besides for the fact that Jason brought all these ideas, the people that were really involved or really liked these ideas were the Jewish aristocracy. There was the aristocracy who also became Hellenized and wanted to know about the hip new modern culture, about the new ideas, of what was going on. As I say, modern times they're really woke. I don't know if anyone used that term. They wanted to know what's going on, and they really enjoyed it because besides for being on top and socially what they knew what was going on, they also had a lot of financial benefits from it. They were able to trade between polises to polises. They were also able to have a closer connection with the king of the time, and it was really, really beneficial towards it. But Jason, although he brought in these Hellenistic ideas, he was seen technically as a moderate Hellenizer. He didn't completely forsake everything Jewish, the Torah, the temple, the service. What was going on in the Beit HaMikdash at the time, he didn't touch that. He left it as religiously, he left it as the way the service is supposed to be. It was just more of the cultural aspect, the things that were outside of the Mikdash, things that were outside of that like holy realm that he brought in these Hellenistic ideas. Professor Schiffman gives it a really interesting way of seeing it. He writes this really nice sentence where it says, "They were seeking a way to live as Jews within a wider Hellenistic world without abandoning the age-old tradition of Israel." it's a little shaky. I don't know. It makes you shake a little bit. It reminds you a little bit of a struggle that we go through, not just thousands and thousands of years ago, but this is a struggle that we've been through 200 years ago. This is a thing that we went through 50 years ago, and this is something that we're still dealing with today. You know, how to incorporate secular culture into our lives, and how do we embrace the two? So it's something that really is not something that is just totally away from us, and history is not just so far away. It's something that is also now and here and in the present. So there were those, though, who saw Jason as not radical enough. Specifically, the Tobiad family. The Tobiad family, they said, hey, what's he doing? He's bringing in these Hellenistic ideas, but he's like half doing it. So they decided to start up with him. They had a little bit of fighting back and forth, and they basically ousted Jason, and they put their brother Menelaus in charge. So as we see on the timeline, that in 171, Menelaus replaces Jason. He purchased the position just like Menelaus was able to. So Menelaus was Hellenized, but to the umpteenth extreme. He started taking, like we said before with Jason, is that he wouldn't mess with the Mikdash, he wouldn't mess with anything with the Beit HaMikdash, with the sacrifices or any funds or anything like that. Menelaus totally did not care. He took those funds and he gave them the funds and the money and things that were dedicated to the Mikdash, and he brought them to Antiochus. He brought them as gifts towards him and just a way to appease the overarching king. So the fact that Menelaus was so extreme and so radical and mistreating what was rightly dedicated to the Mikdash, and also the fact that he totally just purchased the position and was in no way or shape or form connected to the family of the Kohen Gadol at all, really started to upset Jewish people at the time, the Jews that were living there, people who were just, again, struggling with these ideas of the Hellenistic world, but also with their Jewish ideas. They were really, really upset. So violence started to break out in Jerusalem. And people were fighting, and it became a really sad time. Antiochus the king was given advice by his advisors to say, how about, since there's a little bit of fighting and a little bit of violence that's going on in Judea, we really don't want that going on right now in our portion, in this little portion, but like that border. It's a small area, we don't really care about it, but violence is never a good thing. Please just take Menelaus out of position. You'll take him out, the Jews will be happy, and therefore we'll just be able to control it again and let them do their thing. Antiochus said, nah, I'm not going to do that. Ended up killing the advisors and kept Menelaus in his place. This made Jews even more upset. This made Jews appalled by the way the politics were working and what was going on in the Mikdash, that the upsetment really went out to become a full-scale revolt. So, as the things were becoming even more violent and even more difficult at the time, there was a Seleucid general by the name of Apollonius who said, I'm going to take control and I'm going to try to calm down everything that's going on here in Jerusalem, but more largely in the Judea area. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to build a fortress called Acre. And once I set up that fortress, we're going to have some troops from Seleucid troops. They're going to be there. If anyone steps out of line, we'll keep them calm. Jews saw this, and in order to build a huge fortress, you have to take people out of their own homes and take land from them. And many Jews were just picking up and leaving completely, which is not what they wanted at all. But many Jews were really upset from losing their home and losing their financial security and losing so many things. So this is where, again, things started to escalate even more. So at this time, we see this political unrest, we see this like really social unrest, and Professor Schiffman here suggests that this is also seems that the correct time, seeing Menelaus and his personality as well, that Avodah Zarah and foreign worship, foreign idols, were brought into the Mikdash. Menelaus and the rest of the Jewish Hellenizers, they saw the Jewish God as just like every other god, like this kind of ultimate all-being, this larger emphasis of God, known to this in Syria as Baal Shamin, which is the master of heaven, or in Greek known as Zeus, right? Mm-hmm. Zeus of Olympus. So that's kind of where he got his backing from, to say like, oh, the Jewish God is like Zeus, and therefore we can kind of just like bring in these foreign idols. And it got to this point where Jews were like, enough of this rest. And this is where the first revolt begins. In 168, is the earliest attempt of an organized group of priests known as the Hasidim, or the pious ones, and they were not happy with this, with any of the Hellenization that was going around, and they came out, and the rebellion was just getting even stronger. So Antiochus is looking at this, and Antiochus says, okay, there's unrest. There are Jews that are fighting, and this is getting out of hand. So the two sides that are fighting are really Jews and Hellenized Jews. The two ideas that are clashing are Hellenism, right, and Judaism. And Hellenism is pretty much the way to go, because the rest of the empire is Hellenistic, and that's how to be a good citizen. So if you have this tension between Hellenism and Judaism, one of them's going to go. And therefore, he decided to start dealing with the Judaism problem, per se. And that's when the persecution starts, and that's when Antiochus starts coming out and giving the decrees that we all know about. So sometimes we think about the story of Hanukkah, and we think about it as, oh, Antiochus just woke up one day, and he was just going to give us persecution, and that was it. But we see that there's a lot of backstory as to what was going on, and it kind of enlightens us as to seeing the bigger picture of what was happening within the Jewish community. So Antiochus, by setting up these persecutions, specifically, there are a couple of ideas that he brought in. And he really set this up in the year 167/166. It's a little unclear exactly when it started on the count. But he started bringing in foreign idolatrous worship and into the temple. There were the Shabbat and the festivals were being violated all over. The Jews were not allowed to keep Shabbat. Additionally, like we said before, circumcision was, like we all know that in Brit Milah, circumcision was not allowed. The laws of Kashrut, those were not allowed. High places like Bamot were built outside and to serve God, and they were also being served with unkosher animals. So some people know the story of Matityahu and the pig and serving all these things. This comes from a basis of like worshiping and giving sacrifices outside of the temple. Additionally, the penalty for all of these things, for either keeping your Jewish mitzvot or for not doing those other things, was death. And Antiochus had people really enforcing these ideas, because he was trying to just uproot and take out this whole Jewish idea, and that way everyone else could just be normal Hellenistic citizens. And this was just, by the time these persecutions and rules and everything against the Jews were coming out, this is when we start having the appearance of the Hasmoneans, or the Maccabim. The Maccabim, we know, right? We know about the Maccabean family, Matityahu. And Matityahu says, Matityahu gathers his sons, and they start riling up troops. This is specifically in the winter of 167. And this is when all these persecutions start, and he starts riling up everybody. People were hiding in forests. People were trying to find different ways and really gain a gathering. As time picks up, we have Judah HaMaccabee after Matityahu dies, but they already take control of Judea, of the larger area, and Judah HaMaccabee is the one who takes over. Interesting fact, many historians try to understand where the name Maccabee comes from. So one suggestion is Maccabee, if you spell it with a kuf, it comes with Makav, which means a hammer. So they could have called him like strong like a hammer. Others suggest that he had a hammer-shaped head, but it's probably unlikely. So really, they start riling up everybody and start deciding like we're not doing this anymore, and we have to beat everything that's going on. And they join together, and they start really gaining control. Like we said before, when Matityahu died, they captured Judea. Eventually, Yehuda keeps going, and he says, "No, I want to make sure that Yerushalayim is ours, that the Mikdash is ours." The Jews were restored full right in the later fall of being able to practice their Judaism, and then by the time of December, or the Hanukkah time, or Kislev, is when Yehuda starts coming into Yerushalayim, and everything eventually starts, he cleans up, we have on the 25th of Kislev, which is our story, the Hanukkah story, is Yehuda purifies the temple, Judah HaMaccabee purifies the temple, he relights the menorah, and reorganizes the worship and the sacrificial worship, and the Mikdash is now reset, back to functioning and up and running. So the main objectives of the revolt, which is like ending the persecution and restoring Judaism, were achieved. the story goes on. So this is our little happy ending in a larger story. The larger story is more complex, and just for brevity's sake, we're not going to go into it, and it's not necessarily the most happy, upbeat story. We're all here right now, and we all know a lot about Jewish history, so it's a hard ending. But what we see here is now we get the historical background. Now we have a little taste of really what was going on. It's not just Antiochus coming in and making these decrees, but there's a whole story, there's a whole saga of everything that goes behind it. So this was the first part of what I wanted to talk about today. That was the historical context of the Hanukkah story. Now, the next part that we're going to look at is the rabbinic understanding of what the miracle of Hanukkah is. Okay? So, if I asked you, what's the miracle of Hanukkah? What would you say? Take a minute to think. Okay. Does anyone want to suggest an answer?
The
what?
The oil and the water.
Excellent. Okay, you hit it right on the head. There's the mitzvah, there's a miracle of Nes Pach HaShemen, of the oil, of finding the oil, and also actually reinstating the Mikdash. That's some Rishonim count it as a second miracle, not necessarily a full-on miracle, not as a third kind of miracle, but it together with Nes Pach HaShemen. And the other thing was the military victory. This is what we know, but we're going to take a step back, and as we turn to the other side of the page, we're going to look at the Gemara to see a little bit more of a background as to what it believes the miracle is. Okay, so the Gemara, the main discussion of Hanukkah is located in Masechet Shabbat when discussing candles. Certain things that you can light with, certain things that you can't light with, and we only have about 2.5 dapim, which are like back and forth, two sides of a paper. We only have about that much discussion of Hanukkah. When it comes to Purim, we have a whole Masechet. We got Masechet Megillah. We got a lot. With Hanukkah, there's not as much written, which is also an interesting point to think about and to look into. But this is really where you'll find the chunk of everything that goes on. So if we look at source number 3, we have this, the first two words are Mai Hanukkah, which literally translates as what is Hanukkah? In yeshivish terms, when you ask people what they're learning the sugya, they're like, oh yeah, we're doing Mai Hanukkah, which sounds like Mai Hanukkah, but it's really Mai Hanukkah, what is Hanukkah? So Mai Hanukkah, what is Hanukkah? Ditanu Rabbanan, as our rabbis teach, Bikath Hei B'Kislev, on the 25th of Kislev, Yomei D'Chanukah, Timna Inun. On the 25th of Kislev, right, there are 8 days of Chanukah, during which we do not eulogize nor we fast. Oh, sorry. Timna Inun, there are 8 of them. Zelo L'Mispeid B'Hon, V'Zelo L'Hit Anot B'Hon, which we don't eulogize nor do we fast. K'shenichnisu HaYavanim L'Heichal, right, when the Greeks came into the Heichal, into the temple, Tim Uet Kol HaShmanim Shebeheichal, they went and they defiled all the shmanim, all the oils that were located in the temple. V'kishagavra Malchut Beit Chashmonai V'nitzchum, and when the Hasmonean monarchy became strong and overcame them, Badku V'lo Matzu, Ela pach echad shel shemen shehaya munach bechotmo shel kohen gadol. They searched and could find only one jar of oil stamped with the seal of the kohen gadol. Right? Velo hayabo ela lahadlik yom echad. The jar contained only enough oil to last for only one night. Naase bo nes behidliku mimeno shmona yamim. Right? But a miracle happened, and it remained lit for 8 days. L'shana acheret, right, the following year, the next year, l'shana acheret, kav'um v'asa'um yomim tovim v'halel v'hoda'a. We see that next year they established these days as holidays with praise and thanksgiving. So now that we see what the Gemara has to say about it, this is one of the earlier sources that we have, what does the Gemara say the miracle is? What? Pach Shemen, the oil. Right? The oil is the miracle, according to what we have here in the Gemara. So if we have the oil, there's no mention, though. I mean, there's a mention. There's a nice mention that they won, right? Shegavru. But we see that there's a long explanation of oil, and they found it, and they were able to reinstate the Mikdash. So here the Gemara is talking about the fact that there was oil, that they were looking for it, and that and it lasted for 8 days. That's the miracle. That's really the miracle. And if we take a moment to think about what we learned just now in the historical background of what was going on, being able to go back into the Mikdash and reinstate it and relight the candle, that's a big deal. That's a really miraculous thing. We were talking beforehand, we talked about times of religious persecution, where they couldn't keep Shabbat, they couldn't keep Kashrut, they couldn't keep anything. The fact that their Jewish identity was really at a loss, at a place where they couldn't figure it out, where they couldn't practice openly, and to be able to come back to the Mikdash, find it, and then find the oil, and be able to light it and serve God, that's incredible. And that's what the Gemara is picking up on here. So that's one side of the miracle. But we said that there's another side of the miracle, which was the military victory. The military victory is mentioned where there's another source that we tell the story of Hanukkah about, right? When we say Birkat HaMazon, when we bench, or when we pray, we say Al HaNisim. And from Al HaNisim, I was looking at between the Nusach Ashkenaz and the Nusach Edot HaMizrach. There are not so many different. There is really no difference between the two written. My father's also Yemenite, as a side note. So I also looked at the Yemenite version, and it's pretty much all the same. These all date back to Amram Gaon, right, there we go. So who is a Gaon, who was in Babel in the time of 875. So really, this is one of the Nusachim. This is a tefillah that was passed around and said by everyone. So let's take a look inside, and let's see what the miracle was in this source. Okay? Bimei Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Chashmonai. So in the days of Matityahu, the son of Yochanan, the high priest, the Chashmonai Uvanav, and his sons, Kishamda Malchut Yaven Harisha'a Alam Chai de Israel, and the wicked empire, Greek empire rose against your people, Israel, right? L'hashkicham mitoratecha, to make them forget your Torah. U'l'habiram michukei ritzonecha, and to steer them away from your laws that you want. Va'ata berachamecha harabim, and you with your great mercy, amadeta lahem be'et saratam. You were there and you stood for them in their time of need. Ravda et rivam, you battled their battles. You battled their battles. Danta ad dinam, you judged their laws. Nakamta ad nikmatam, right? You took vengeance upon their vengeance. Masarta giborim biyad chalashim, you handed over, or you gave up the mighty into the hands of the weak. Virabim biyad me'atim, and many in the hands of few. Utmeim biyad tehorim, and the impure ones in the hands of the pure ones. Urshaim biyad tzadikim, and in the evil ones in the hands of the tzadikim. V'zeidim b'yad oskei toratecha, and the intentional sinners in the hands of those who are engaged in your Torah. V'lo ulcha asita shem gadol v'kadosh ba'olamecha, and to you you made your holy and great name in your world, lam ulam cha Yisrael, and for you and for your people of Israel, asita tshua gdola, you did a huge miracle, something miraculous in salvation, ufor kan, and a deliverance, kahayom hazeh, as you did on this day, v'achar kach, and that was a huge miracle, v'achar kach, and afterwards, ba'u vanecha, right, your children had come, l'dvir beitecha, to your temple, ufinu atecha lecha, and they cleaned up the heichal, v'tiheru mikdashecha, and they made it pure, v'hidliku neirot b'chatzrot, and they lit the candles in your holy temple. V'kavu shmonat yimei Chanukah elu lehodot ulalel shimcha hagadol, and they established these 8 days of Chanukah as the days of praise and thanksgiving to your great name. So we take a look, and this is something we say multiple times a day on Chanukah. Right? It's less. We focus more on this source actually than instead of learning the Gemara over and over from day to day to day to day. But this is something we say all the time. And what do we see that the miracle is based on this source? The miracle here is the military victory, right? The miracle of the military, of the great were given to the great and big were given to the hands of the small and the few. And we see that there's the military victory was something miraculous. And now let's think about it in the historical context that we just learned, right? We have this huge empire. We had half of Alexander the Great's empire, the Macedonians. And we see that half of it was coming against the Jewish people. You have Antiochus. You have people who are going and fighting in a huge empire fighting against us. And yet we are able to bind together, even in the time where, yes, it was right beforehand, there was times of civil war, but we're able to bind together and fight and win and able to gain that religious freedom. So we see from these two sources, and Rishonim ends up splitting in different directions, of the Rambam also really highlights the military victory, but each one of the Rishonim really takes a different approach as to what the miracle was, and there are actually many different, there's like halachic discussions as when it comes to that as well, as how do you celebrate the holiday, are you supposed to have parties and feasts, and is it like Purim, is it not like Purim, and this whole idea evolves around the sides of the miracle, and what is the miracle. So I think that by looking at the two miracles, though, we see that there are two really important lessons that we can take away from understanding what's going on here. We spoke about the oil, right? The oil, the miracle of the oil is kind of this reinstitution, this reinstatement of being able to serve God again, being able to connect after something that we lost for so much time. We didn't have a temple to serve, and being able to come back to that, being able to come back to that point. And again, when looking at the military victory, we have this point of being able to come together and beat out an enemy that was trying to kill us. We see that these are two very different ideas. There's an idea of kind of this religious experience, a religious, maybe a little more individual, but really a religious connection. And then there's more of a nationhood idea, this idea of coming together as one. And I think these are two aspects of, like, when people think about their religious experience, when their overall Jewish experience or Jewish identities, there's so many ways to connect to Hashem and to connect to God and to connect to our nation as a whole. But people find their different ways. And these are two ways that sometimes people really identify with. So you have that first component. You have that first religious, being able to restart and reconnect to God through mitzvot, through learning, through so many other kinds of things. And that this time, sometimes there are very prescribed times, though, where it's really... it's really easy, not easy, but it's easier to reconnect with God and reconnect with your religious experience, right? At those times are really the Yamim Noraim, the high holidays. Those are like in your face. It's time for you to stop and think about your connection with God, right? So we have those ideas. But additionally, there are certain stages in our life where we also find that it's easier to connect to God. Sometimes it's when I could take my time, some students spend a year learning in Israel, or some people will take time and just go to classes at night, or sometimes in your life you find that things are a little bit of, it's nice, like you're able to find that time. Sometimes Shabbos is a little bit more time where you can kind of fit in that time, which is really nice and prescribed to be able to have that. But there's not always that prescribed time. There's not always that wonderful opportunity that's staring you at the face where you can just really reconnect. As a side point, when we talk about the mitzvah of the Chanukah candles, right, there's a big debate between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Beit Hillel says, how many candles do we light? We start on day one with one, and then we add. Each day, we add another one. Because ma'alim bakodesh ve'in moridim. We go up by one. Beit Shammai, and which is a really nice and wonderful idea that we have as well, and we paskin like Beit Hillel. But Beit Shammai, on the other hand, has an idea of we start with eight, and each night we take away from one. So if you look at Beit Shammai's opinion, you're just like, what is Beit Shammai doing? Is he just opposite of Beit Hillel? Because there's always an argument between the two of them. Like, where does he get this idea of eight and going down to one? So Beit Shammai is looking at the fact that there's a connection between Chanukah and Sukkot. Between Chanukah and lighting the candles, and Sukkot, where it was a time where we came back and it was Aliyah LaRegel, and being able to come to the Mikdash. As part of the Korbanot that were given on Sukkot, every day it was called the Korbanot Nisim. It was based on that. And each day there was an X amount of Korbanot that were given. And the following day, one Korban was removed. It was diminished. So according to Beit Hillel, right? Beit Shammai's approach here is that we missed out on Sukkot at the time of Chanukah. The Beit HaMikdash was defiled, it was destroyed, it was unable to. So when the Jews were able to go ahead and restore the Mikdash, they were able to go ahead and re-celebrate the Sukkot that they lost out on. They were able to go ahead and now light the candles. So that's why we would go down from 8 to 7, to 6, to 5, to 4, to 3, to 2, to 1. We're missing, Chanukah is the kind of this tikkun, this fixture, a fix of the time for Sukkot. So I think by Beit Shammai connecting Chanukah to Sukkot as well, We see that beforehand we were just talking about prescribed times. Certain times, like we were saying before, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, those are all times where it's really easy to feel God or feel that religious connection or to be able to just say, like, I'm here, I can serve you. Or even if you take it back in the calendar, before Sukkot we have Yom Kippur, and before that we have Rosh Hashanah, and before that we have Elul, where you're like the whole month you could just sit and be learning about Shuvah and everything else. And then before that you have Av, so you're like, oh, Tisha B'Av. And then before that is Shiva Asar B'Tammuz. So it's really set time. Certain things are built in our schedule. But now here in Kislev, we're standing here, and we're just like, it's dark. It gets dark at 4:30. We're just like, I'm done for the day. I can't anymore. But even in this time of complete darkness, there can still be that light. There can still be that opportunity of going back and reconnecting. There's still that time where we can stop, we can find the oil, and we can light, and we can rededicate ourselves. And I think that's one message and one side from highlighting the fact that there's Nespach HaShemen. That Nespach HaShemen is coming to teach us that it doesn't matter what time of the year it is. It doesn't matter where we are. It doesn't matter how crazy life is, or how dark things are, or how dark times are. We saw historically how dark the times were. Yet able to stop and reevaluate and rethink. And it doesn't have to be something big or glorious. It could just be, well, kol kavod to all of you guys for coming out tonight to a shir, which is like really impressive. And I'm so late also. But like doing that, or focusing on a mitzvah that you might want to work on. Please don't let it be lashon hara, because it's like the same thing as I'm starting my diet tomorrow. Because sometimes, I mean, it's important, but not something big, something small, something attainable, something that's like really, that you can connect to, something that can be done, whether it's, you know, take a day and learn a perek, and that's it, or focus on one perek of Tanakh, or something like that. Having that religious experience, that religious connection, and being able to reconnect yourself to your Judaism. And that's one side, and that's what we get from Nespach HaShemen. But on the opposite side, we have the military victory. And the military victory is a sense of nationhood. We were in the midst, we saw, of violence and breaking out between Jews and Jews amongst themselves. Yet, once we know that the rest of the world is out to get us, we stop everything that we do, and we stick together. It doesn't matter who we are, who it is, if you're messing with us, we're all together. And sometimes it takes these big world events, these big world things to shake us. But sometimes we don't really need that big world event to shake us. That we're really strong together, and there's so many things that we can do. There's so many things that we could do as a Jewish nation. So if there's a cause that you're passionate about, don't just say, like, I'm going to start a whole charity, which you can, which is incredible. But sometimes we can take smaller steps. We can take these steps of saying, you know, I'm really passionate about the Aguna issue, so maybe I'm going to start and read up a little bit more about it. Maybe if I want, I'll contribute a little bit more to it. Maybe I can talk to my friends about it. Just read an article and discuss and see if anyone else is thinking about it, whether it's the Aguna issue. Or years ago, we were a big part of the Jewish community was dedicating to the Jews of the Soviet Union, right? There were people who were risking their lives out there. But not even just that. There are not these big, grand gestures of nationhood, but even these small things that we care about. And we see that even at times that we've seen in our history that there are small, the small can defeat the many, right? We have 67, we had 48, we had 67, we had all these wonderful miracles where we know that by together we're a lot stronger. And some people can connect to that side of their Jewishness, that side of nationhood, that side of being together, of bringing together, of just being able to focus together and work hard and come together as a nation. And that's what the nace of the military victory is really trying to show us here. And I think that just now, by Hanukkah time, right, we have this time where we light candles and, like, hint, there's, like, this little part where you can, you know, not supposed to do melacha, but, like, we can just take that time for ourselves. Like, let's do that. Let's take that moment where we just, like, can just sit and do nothing. Like, it's really nice. And let's take that moment where we could just sit and reflect. Like, take that moment and think about what it means to you, whether it's the side of when you're lighting your Chanukiah, if you're thinking about the nace of Nespach HaShemen, or you're thinking of the military victory, just take that moment, light the candles, look at the lights, take in the light, and then make sure to reflect. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If anyone has any more questions...